Accession number 18263, Reel 1.
Dick Cooper, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
At Roehampton.
Which year was this?
1932.
Did you grow up and have your schooling at Roehampton?
I went to school at Roehampton until I was about 10 years of age. Then I got a scholarship and went to the Latimer Grammar School at Hammersmith.
And so you were a schoolboy during the Second World War?
Yes.
What was it like being a schoolboy in the Surrey area at that time?
Well, as a child, when the war broke out, I was about 7. And I can recall that we were very, very frightened at that age. But as the war went on, you know, the first part of the war, what they called the False War, as the war went on, we got more and more blasé and excited about it. And so at the age of about 10, we weren't worried about air raids or anything like that. We used to run the streets looking for pieces of shrapnel. I can remember being in Roehampton swimming pool when a doodle bug came over and watching it stop, and it must have landed somewhere in Wandsworth. We got the street I lived in was bombed at both ends. Streets behind were bombed. But at that age, it was sort of, there was an excitement about it rather than anything else.
Can you remember which streets the bombs hit?
There was a bomb in Parkstead Road. There was a bomb in the Pleasance.
What was your address in Roehampton?
45 Parkstead Road.
Was that road hit?
At the end, at the far end. We lived at one end. It would be about, 100, 120 yards away where the bomb dropped the other end. The street behind was hit. Dover House Road was hit.
Which were the worst, the bombs or the UV weapons?
For where we lived, the bombs. I can remember one occasion, if I may say so, where we were sitting having dinner about midday on a Saturday, and a Heinkel came low over. It had been hit by the ACAC, probably from Richmond Park, and it was coming, broad daylight, fairly sunny day, coming low over Roehampton, and it jettisoned its bombs in the street behind, which was Henty Walk, or whatever bombs it had left, which flattened two or three houses, and eventually, apparently, the plane crash-landed in King George's Park in Southfields, Wandsworth.
Did you see that happen?
Did I?
See that happen?
I saw the plane, but I didn't see the bombs drop. We could hear the plane, we were looking out the window, saw the plane coming over.
But there weren't very many V1 strikes in your area.
No. We could hear the doodlebugs. We called them doodlebugs, not V1s. We could hear the doodlebugs coming over, but and we could hear them stop, and then you waited for that 4 or 5 seconds for it to drop and then explode. And I can still, my mind's ear, I can hear that brrrr, that noise of them coming over.
What about V2s?
Never heard one. Never experienced anything to do with V2s.
What do you think public morale was like in your area during the war?
Very good. I often now talk to my sister and my brother about what life was like during the war. Everybody was considerate. People would queue, never any pushing in queues. Bus queues would be orderly. Life was orderly. Everybody was on ration. And everybody accepted it. I thought the morale during the war was great, from a child's point of view. And that's a memory that stayed with me.
Were you ever frightened during the war?
Oh, yeah, during air raids. You know, and especially at night, you'd be lying in bed and the warning would go off, and your mother or your father would come up and get you out of bed and take you downstairs so you'd get into a shelter. You know, and it did frighten you. Beginning of the war was really frightening, you know, because we didn't know what to expect when we were children. But as we went on, as I say, we got more used to it, and it became a big adventure to the children. We used to go out collecting shrapnel, as I've said, and looking for pieces. It was a prize if you could find a piece of a German bomb or even a piece of shrapnel that had a number on it, especially had German numbers on it, like a fin of an incendiary bomb, something like that, was a prize.
And what about your education at the Latimer? Was that disrupted at all?
Only when it was the same sort of thing. When an air raid came and you were at school, of course you all had to evacuate to a shelter. But other than that, you know, there didn't seem to be a lot of problem. People got on with what they were doing. They tended to sort of think, well, the war's going on around us, but life must go on.
But could they get the proper staff?
Well, as a child, it never occurred to me whether they had staff worries or not. You know, it never occurred to me.
So there's no question of your being evacuated?
Oh, I was evacuated, yeah. At the beginning of the war, when we were about 7 or 8, my brother and I were evacuated to Aylesbury, Buckinghamshire.
How did that go?
Well, it went fine, but we missed home so badly, and we constantly badgered my mother to bring us back home again. And so after a length of time, I can't recall how long, we went back to live in Roehampton, and that's when we experienced the raids.
Why were you agitating to go back so much?
Missing home, homesick. The people we were with were fine, but just homesick.
Did the war have any long-term effects on you, do you think?
No, not at all.
Any memories of any troops in the area?
Strangely enough, living at Roehampton, it's fairly close to Wimbledon, and there was a large estate, a large sort of manor house with plenty of open ground around it. It belonged to a member of the Charrington family, the beer people. And during the war, the Royal Norfolks were stationed. It was, you know, unoccupied, and the Royal Norfolks were stationed at this mansion. And as children, we used to walk up this, the Norfolks used to park their lorries, their motor transport, in this long lane, which was overhung with trees. You know, obviously you couldn't see it from the air, you couldn't see the trucks from the air. And as children, we used to climb into the trucks, you know, and they were Royal Norfolk trucks.
What was the attitude of the troops towards the children and civilians?
Well, we didn't have a great deal to do with them. As I say, at the same time, there was Indian soldiers stationed in another part of Roehampton, near the Wimbledon Common. And all the troops were fine. I don't remember any trouble with any of them. You know, not as a child. They were just nice, you know, they were just good people. No problem with any of them.
Any celebrations at the end of the war that you remember?
Other than the street parties, you know, where the people, all the parents got out these long tables, trestle tables, and filled it with what food they had, because rationing was still going on. Other than the street parties, I don't recall a great deal about it.
Now, how did you come to be in the army yourself?
National Service, got called up.
When was that?
Called up in 1951.
How did you feel about that?
Mixed feelings. On the one hand, I recall that none of us were anxious to go because we felt it was a sort of a press gang sort of operation. But on the other hand, nobody, none of us youngsters at the time, wanted the feeling that we were not fit enough to go. So we all wanted to be A1. And if you were A1, you were in. I think if you were A2, you were in, or B2, whatever it was. But certainly if you were A1, you were in.
Where did you go to start off with?
I actually applied to go into the East Surreys, and I was sent to Moore Barracks, Shorncliffe, near Folkestone in Kent. And that's the Home Counties Group Training Centre.
What happened to you there?
What happened? What a cultural change that was. Well, you can loosely say that I went down as a boy and came out as a man. A culture shock. That's what happened down there.
In what way was it a culture shock?
Well, I'd never experienced anything like the army. It was, you know, what happens to you? You go down there, the short haircut. It was in January the 4th, I joined. So you've got really cold weather down on the coast. It's right on the cliffs, Shorncliffe, as the name suggests. You're in these old Moor barracks that were built in Napoleonic times, the barracks. The lino, the brown lino on the floor, the iron bedsteads. There were no proper mattresses. The first thing you were doing, you was given, I think it was called a palliasse, and you went to a big straw store where you stuffed the palliasse with straw, and that was your mattress for the next 6 weeks. And issued blankets and sheets and, you know, and issued clothing that was all too big, or, you know, or webbing that was too stiff, and boots that wouldn't bend. As I say, it was quite a shock, you know. And, of course, you know, army life, where you, instead of your mother shaking you in the mornings to get you up with a cup of tea, you know, it was the door banging open and a loud raucous voice telling you to get out of bed and feet on the floor, you've got 2 minutes, that sort of thing. Oh, yes, it was a shock.
How were you treated by the people in charge?
Well, as you saw, we got the Champlain Platoon certificates. At the time, we felt that we were being treated really badly, but when you look back on it, you realise that it was the old army way of doing things, break you down and build you up in the way they want you to be built up. And it was fine, it was character building, I thought. Looking back, great. At the time, purgatory.
But how exactly do they break you down?
Well, it's, you know, it's, everything's disciplined. You march everywhere. You've got to be smart all the time. You've got to be on your best behaviour all the time. You've got to do immediately what you're told to do. Silly things come into it. Like, if you're making an excuse to an NCO for why you've done something which, you know, is, they consider wrong, you say, but I thought, and he says, you're not paid to think. And then the next time you do something, he says, why don't you think before you act? You know, so you could never win. It's quite funny, really. You can never win in the army. But they do install a spirit of esprit de corps. You do come away feeling that you're part of something. I did, especially when I was in the Norfolks. They do make you feel you're part of something.
So that's the building upside.
That's the building upside. They give you that. If you were a loner in the army, you're now not a loner. You feel part of something. If I can give you an instance, there was a chap, his name was Weller, Sam Weller, as I remember. And he was quite well-spoken chap, and he was obviously going to officer training school. And I can remember we were in the army for about a fortnight, and he went up to the orderly sergeant, a chap called O'Neill. But he was a corporal, but he was a platoon sergeant, rather. And although he only had 2 stripes. And he went up to him, and I was standing near the corporal at the time, and he was complaining about the chaps in the barrack room were constantly swearing, which is normal in the army. And and the corporal was sort of looking at him, flabbergasted, and sort of thinking, what do you want me to do about it, you know? And within about the time we'd ended up our basic training, this chap Sam Weller was swearing the same as everybody else. What mummy said when he went home, I don't know.
You know? Why do you think they sweared?
Well, it's part and parcel of it. It's even, you know, everybody in the army seems to, in those days, I don't know what it's like now, always seemed to swear, whether it was some sort of bravado, I don't know. Every sentence had a swear word. And it didn't mean anything. It was just the way everybody was. Officers were the same, especially when we were in Korea, you know. Nobody took any notice of it, but it was quite amusing when I think back about this chap complaining about the swearing.
This is the F word, is it?
Everything, you know. If there was a word, we'd use it. It was very amusing, actually.
Do you think the basic training did you any good then?
I think I'm one of the few, well, perhaps there's more of me, but people think like that. The army was wonderful for me. I went in the army weighing 9 stone 3, I still remember. I was, you know, small. I smoked like a trooper, even at that age, 18. I would drink, you know, like kids do. I came out of the army weighing 12 stone 4, didn't drink, never drunk since, never smoked since. So that's what the army did for me. I owed the army a great deal.
And how tall were you?
I'd filled out, of course, you know, I'd weighed a lot more, but I don't know about the height. I can't remember how high I was. I suppose I grew a little bit. But the army did a lot for me. I'd never made my bed before in the army. You know, when I came out of the army, no problem, is it? I felt when I went in the army that I was work shy. I didn't want to get up in the mornings and anything like that. When I came out of the army, it didn't bother me. In fact, I worked, you know, for years, you know, and no problem going to work. Never fazed me. The army was a making of me, I think, even though I only served, well, I served 5.5 years all told, because I had the 3.5 years compulsory TA, but, you know.
And were you doing this basic training in the summer of 51, or what season?
No, it was January we got there. January, February we did the basic training. Freezing cold at Shorncliffe.
And after the basic training, what then?
What they call the next 10 weeks training. I can't really call it. After basic training, you've got another 10 weeks of training. I forget what they call that, advanced training or whatever they call it. I can't remember the name they use for it. But after basic training, you tended to get sent to your battalions or where they want to send you. And the Home Counties Group Training Centre consisted of Surrey's, Buffs, Sussex, Middlesex, Fusiliers, Royal West Kents, all the home counties. Their recruits, or, you know, their potential recruits, were sent there for their basic training. Having completed your basic training, you generally were sent, unless you were going on a course or an officer's training course or some other cadre, you were generally sent off to your battalions. And I and others were sent off to join the 1st Battalion of the East Surreys in Barnard Castle in Durham, another warm place.
What happened there exactly?
Oh, extensive training up and down the hills in Durham.
Did you like that any better?
The weather was the worst thing, the weather up there. Boy, was it cold. And then we, with the battalion, we came down to Stanford PTA at Norfolk. I seem to have a lot of associations with Norfolk, don't I? We came down, with the battalion, we came down to the Stanford PTA, which is near Brandon, Thetford, Norfolk, for battle training, that sort of thing. When we finished that, funnily enough, the East Surreys went down to Shorncliffe. And we were at Shorncliffe whilst the war in Korea had started in June 1950. Before I joined the army, the war was raging in Korea. When we got down to Shorncliffe with the East Surreys, that's when the various regiments, I imagine, were being, recruits were being taken out of various regiments to go to the Royal Norfolks, who'd come back from Germany under strength, but were due to go to Korea. So a contingent from the East Surreys were posted to become Norfolks. That's how I got to be in the Norfolks. And that would have been about June, I imagine. Something like the end of May, June in 51.
How did you feel about changing your regimen?
Apprehensive, because, you know, for the fact that we knew we were going to Korea. And I like the Surreys. If, you know, again, you've got that feeling of belonging. And the Surreys were a nice regiment to be in. You know, we got messed about, chased uphill, down, down. But if you could stand that, there was, it was still a, it still had the feeling that we belonged there, and it was good to be in the Surreys. But of course, we were sent to the Norfolks, and we were apprehensive about going to Korea. But what was the alternative? The people in the West Kents and others were being sent to Malaya. So one way or the other, you're going to get some active service. You know, we felt a little resentful being national servicemen, you know, on the proverbial 28 shillings a week, which is £1.40 in today's money. You know, that was worth a bit more in those days, but we felt a bit apprehensive and fearful, but excited, you know, like, as you would at that age. It was always a sort of, you're always in two minds. On the one hand, you wanted to do it. On the other hand, you didn't want to do it.
So what preparations had to be made for going out there?
Well, we joined the Norfolks, and where did we go when we joined the Norfolks? We were sent to Crowborough.
Is this in Berkshire? Somewhere near Windsor.
That's it, down that way, yeah. And we just trained with them. I think we went back to... I think we went back to the Stanford PTA for a while. Get a little bit confused here. I think we went back there for a while. But we came back to Crowborough. It was at Crowborough where we organised for going to Korea. We sort of mobilised.
What did that involve?
Well, that involved a change of webbing. We got rid of the old 39 stuff that you used to blanco, which was terrible, and we got the 44 pattern, which was the green that you never blancoed, that sort of thing, which we really liked. That was blancoing out the door. That was an awful thing, blancoing.
Why?
Oh, God. You'd go out on, with the Norfolks, and Norfolks were very strict, very disciplined regiment. You've met Paul Boxall, my old sergeant major. We was always expected to be immaculate. So we'd go out on a scheme or something, or a manoeuvre, and our blanco would be all nice. The brasses would be shiny. Well, staying out overnight or crawling around in the mud, next day you came back, it could be pouring with rain. Your blanco was, you know, your equipment was filthy. And by the next day, it all had to be cleaned and brasses shined. And we were going on parade the next day in the rain with the blanco still soaking wet on the belts and stuff. And the gaiters, it could be soaking wet. You know, the blanco just wouldn't dry. And that was soul destroying, trying to get yourself clean and tidy. And of course, the slightest blemish on your brasses or your equipment, and you're in trouble.
So the green webbing at Crowborough made you happy?
Much happier. The 44 stuff, yeah. Oh, yeah, great.
Anything else that happened at Crowborough?
Other than training, we were organising ourselves and getting organised, and we were getting lectures on what was expected of us, and we were, and as the Norfolks, as I said, were very depleted of personnel when they came back from Germany due to go to Korea, so they'd got lots of NCOs from, I think it was the Northumberland Regiment, the NCOs had come from there, and the officers had come from different places, and the men had come from different places. Although it was an Norfolk regiment, there was a great deal of Londoners in it, as there would be, and we'd all come together. We needed to get to know each other, and that's what the time was spent, getting to know each other.
By the way, I think Crowborough is in Sussex, come to think of it.
Yeah, I thought of that afterwards. I think it is in Sussex, yeah. Crowborough, Sussex, yeah.
What happened next?
Well, that was it. And then we went on, we were told that when we were going, and we went on embarkation leave, and I was I turned 19 when I was on embarkation leave. And we came back, that was on the August the 18th, I was on embarkation leave. We came back to the depot after leave, and that was it. Crowborough Station, train down to Southampton, and on the 30th of August, we embarked on the Empire Orwell, on the Great Adventure.
What was the voyage like?
Pretty good. I'd never been on a ship before. I'd never been abroad before. Again, it was like a big adventure, but it was claustrophobic in as much as you got about, I don't know, 700 troops on the ship. Perhaps more when you've got different detachments going out that way. I remember that there were some Air Force personnel on there. Don't know where they were going, but and then you've got the ship's crew and everything else. It wasn't too bad. We all had duties to do, jobs to do, you know, mostly fatigue type jobs, you know, carting stores around from the holds up and that sort of thing. But it was a lot of training going on, keep fit, PT exercises, shooting over the stern of the ship at balloons. They would blow up balloons and throw them over, and we would practice shooting. I don't ever remember anybody hitting a balloon. We were that good. And we would fire rifles and bring guns over the back, that sort of thing. And the crew organised picture shows, cinema shows, when we got, you know, where the weather was better, you know, going through the Mediterranean and the Red Sea. We could watch films, you know, in the open air, you know, in the stern of the ship. The crew would organise that. It wasn't too bad, actually. And calling in, you'd only go about, for instance, when we got to Gibraltar, the ship stopped, but we never got shore leave. But then we got as far as Egypt, port side. We got shore leave there, down through the Red Sea. The captain of the ship, who I never met, probably saw him. One of the remarks he made, because it was printed in one of the journals, one of the Norfolk journals, he said it was he'd been through the Suez Canal 120 something times, and it had never felt so hot as when he went through with the Orwell with us lot on board. It was stifling, the heat. And so that was an experience. And then we stopped at Aden, again at Colombo, which was Ceylon in them days, not Sri Lanka. And then again we stopped at Hong Kong, and then we landed the ship docked at Pusan in South Korea. It docked at Pusan on the 30th of September. And we disembarked, we stayed overnight on the ship and disembarked off the ship the next day. We were welcomed by one of those American Negro bands, you know, with the white hat or helmets, immaculately turned out, you know, playing all sorts of marches.
What were your first impressions of the country?
Awe, fear. When we approached Pusan, it was misty. It looked a dark grey country, and the huge great hills. I don't suppose, what do you call them, mountains, I suppose, but you had this vision of mountains, and it was grey and overcast. And it looked a frightening place. You know, we hadn't expected it to be like that, you know. But we soon sort of knuckled down to it, you know.
And you presumably you didn't stay in Pusan?
Oh, no. Straight off the boat. I remember...